Hello, this is Jay Stowe, reading from Esquire's October 2019 issue with John Mulaney on the cover. I'm going to pick up where I left off last week, about halfway through, a profile of the Syracuse University basketball coach Jim Boeheim. We're in the mellow, waiting for his wife, who's going on tour with us through some of the projects their charitable foundation has funded. While he waits in his office, Boeheim can watch over two practice courts and dozens of training devices designed to improve the heaving of three-pointers, the pinpointing of free throws, the act of exploding up court with newfangled urgency. Mello may have saved his career, he says, extended it anyway. This job is all time and space, Boeheim says. This building, this office in the view, that takes care of the space. It saved me. I'm not always walking around building to building to get a look. The team wants to be here, in this space. They can get in here 24 hours a day. He looks at me, purses his lips. They have key cards, he explains. So the mellow gives him the space he needs. What about the time? That's where the trademark zone defense enters. I ask the standard question. What's with the zone? Boeheim smiles and states that his persistent use of the zone is strictly a method of budgeting practice time so he's most free to teach. Time and space, he repeats. There's an economy to every practice. We practice 2 hours. When you play man-to-man, you have to devote an hour and 15 minutes to drill work. Every day. You have to practice zone, too. That's 30 minutes. So that's the whole practice. 2 hours. No choice. Boeheim looks out at the court as he speaks. He wants me to understand. And the thing about Boeheim when he's trying to explain something, to me, to a ref, to a player during a timeout, or a practice, or from across the floor at the Carrier Dome at full decibel, you can't not understand him. You can't not get him. He speaks so plainly and with such conviction that there's not a lot of room for misunderstanding. He's boiling it down, hard as he can, all while watching out of the corner of one eye the practice routine of a local player who's training for an upcoming season in Italy. Now, if you play all zone, you got to spend an hour on it, he was saying. Once you start spending an hour on your zone, you can't just go back, spend 15 minutes on man-to-man, and try to use it. Man-to-man is different every game. It's just not going to work. So we did away with it. It's like a lesson plan, then. He purses his lips again, shrugs. Not many people know that, but it's factual. It's a fact, he says. Is he ever tempted to experiment with man-to-man defense? This isn't an experiment, he says sharply. You only get one chance, and if you experiment during a game that you need to win, and you lose it because you experimented, what did you learn? And then you miss the tournament by one game? It's not good. Understood. His wife picks us up in the parking lot of the Mello for our tour of the good works of the Jim and Julie Boeheim Foundation. It's a big SUV with a pile of golf clubs sitting in one half of the back seat. Drivers, big, fat-headed drivers that appear to have been tested and rejected by someone filling out their bag. She offers me my choice. Take one, she says. They belong to no one at this point. You should take one. This is Julie Boeheim, his second wife, for more than 20 years now. The mother of three of his four kids, all three of whom are playing college basketball within a reasonable driving distance from one another. A son at Cornell, a daughter at Rochester, and Buddy at Cuse. Boeheim attends their home games religiously. He loves those moments in the stands. It's a part of the hoops heaven he lives in at present. He doesn't feel pulled apart by competing obligations. Not at all, he says. That's what holds me together. Julie is Boeheim's energetic counterpart, talkative, challenging, focused like a laser. She drives. Boeheim's future as a driver is at this point still uncertain, pending the state's decision following the hearing. His license would be fully reinstated several weeks later. It is an unstated tension. Boeheim looks at the city, a bit dislocated as passenger. Each time we stop for a look at one of their foundation's many good projects, I ask him what neighborhood we are in. That seems to puzzle him. This is Western Syracuse, he says at one point. He looks at the sky. I don't know what they call it. Boeheim settles in the passenger seat, reaches for the stereo once or twice, turns it down. He's a known Springsteen fan. And on our way to a boys and girls club on the southern side of the city, I ask him, what Springsteen does he usually play? Nothing, Boeheim says. I mostly listen to sports or the golf channel on my way to work. I thought you liked the boss, I say. Nah, Boeheim says, demurring. He sniffs after a second, having rethought. I mean, yeah. Another pause. It seems that he's grinding out an answer. Once in a while, I'll listen to him, he allows. I may put on the Springsteen station. That's as specific as he gets. He doesn't want to grasp for song titles or lyrics. But I'm not big on tapes, and I have his albums, a couple of them, but, I mean, tracks, but I just never really play. He drifts away then, looks out the window, takes a breath. I don't play music. I really don't. I used to. I'm sorry. Nothing to apologize for, I tell him. The moment is uncomfortable, and again it occurs that driving itself may be the issue. He sat through the hearing, 2 hours during which the February accident was reconstructed and recounted in order to establish the facts, just 4 days prior. It was Boeheim's chance to retain his driving privileges. A newspaper account reported that the judge warned Boeheim that the proceedings might be painful. As the accident was recounted, the local paper said, Boeheim laid his head on his arms as he listened. Whether Boeheim is feeling any tension as we bounce from the boys' club to an outdoor basketball court to a first tee golf center, he does not say. In any case, at one point, Boeheim says, simply, dancing in the dark. What's that, I ask? I like that one song, he says. I do listen to that one. It's not a song I know well. Top 40 Bruce. And the word, seriously, slips out. I regret it immediately. I mean, when do you listen? After games? Boeheim doesn't seem to notice my response or my question. He's regarding the street in front of us. It's a song about hating the place you are, the place you find yourself. I can remember one line. There's a joke here somewhere, and it's on me. No, he says, as we pull into the parking lot of the Boys and Girls Club, and that's it on the song. The Boys and Girls Club is a rough business. The edge is a little frayed, well used. It provides meals for neighborhood kids twice a day for the entire summer. The floors are polished by the shoes of 1,000 running children on 100 afternoons. The Boeheim Foundation rebuilt this place, but it hardly looks flashy or over-designed. We traipse from the computer room to the gymnasium and back out to the cafeteria, such as it is. At one point, Boeheim stands in front of me with his hands in his pockets. The roof was a wreck when we started this, he says, and the HVAC needed to be replaced. No one much wants to step in and build a new roof in a facility like this. It's not hard to fund a basketball court. We knew someone would step in for that, so we did the roof. This place has to be here. These kids use it all year. He shrugs and stares at me. We redid the electrical, too, and the wireless or something. It might be hard to see the impact, he says. It is not. The place is solid, permanent. It feels like it has always been here. It is just a modest surface, like the man who's talking. Back at the Mellow, Boeheim reflects on 43 years in the game. What's the biggest change? I offer one. The transfer portal that allows student-athletes to transfer their eligibility from school to school, a fairly free market process. It was initially thought to favor large programs like Syracuse, because players might seek to work up from smaller schools to the premier programs as their prospects improved. Of course, players might leave Syracuse as well. To which Boeheim says, I think it's great for kids to go if that's what they really want, but what if they just work through it? Would it have worked out better? Brandon Trish played very little here when he was a freshman, and he became a great player for us. We had a kid leave here and go to Vanderbilt. He didn't play, and Vanderbilt didn't win a conference game last year. The biggest difference, he says, is the culture of impatience and expectation that's taken over amongst the players. They just want to play in the NBA. 20 years ago, nobody even thought that much about the NBA. And they're not going to get there. The NBA thinks it's a problem. They're worried about it. There's no place. There are 600 players in the G League. Every one of those guys thinks they're going to go to the NBA. Not even 30 of them are going to. There's no place for these guys, and we're making a culture of, let's go, now. They don't want to go to college. They don't accept what it means. And the effect? What we've needed to do is give kids more money, which we have. People don't realize that. Nobody writes this. These kids get paid. My son gets $1,300 a month. He's a scholarship player because we give him cost of attendance. In cash, I ask? In cash. And they take their board money instead of eating meals, and they buy their own food. But we also provide food for them, legally now, twice a day. Boeheim shakes his head. He makes that look like, you get me? Finally, we are alone, talking about potboilers and detective novels. He's a Michael Connelly man. I decide I have to ask about the accident, the man he hit on I-690. The PR guy had politely asked me to keep my distance from the subject. I'd promised only that I'd do my best. This feels like an opportunity, unless I'm misreading things. I apologize and let him know that I'm waiting in. Asking, he says, repeating the last word I used. He's leaning back in his desk chair, arm wrapped over his ribs, as if suppressing an ache. Yeah, he says, that's fine. I don't have a problem with you asking. I offer him another out. We can do it later. I don't have a problem, he says. The crazy thing is, I've had 500 emails minimum, perfectly serious. More than 500 emails from people that had the same thing happen to them. The testimony, the inquest, or whatever, it's hard. And it should be hard. They looked into it. Every minute was accounted for. Going over one small set of reactions, one sequence of actions where you do your level best and it's not enough. It's a miserable thing because a man was killed, he says. He pauses, then sighs, pushes his glasses up his nose. He's worrying. And his family. He lets another moment pass, then, you know, I've been very smart in a way. I stopped drinking completely. Do you mean that day? I mean altogether, he says. He means years ago. I stopped drinking. Not that I ever drank that much. Because if I'd just had two drinks that night, just two, he holds up two fingers, a reverse peace sign. Even if I had one, he says, staring at the wall above my head, they'd ask, were you drinking? Again and again. And I would have had to say, well, I had one drink. That would be the headline. They'd say, drinking? So even if you had two, or say you were just at the limit. He holds out his hand, splays out his fingers, ticks off the register of events that would surely follow. Fired, prosecuted probably, all that. Even sober, it was an impossible scenario. I came over a hill, and it was pitch black, and the other car was black. So I'm coming over the hill. I didn't see it. I thought I was going to just go straight into the car, but I got around. I actually made a move, because there was nobody in the road, to get past the car. As I'm going by, the guy steps out. There's a pause then. Boeheim stares past the front of his desk, thinking it through. He'd gone back to the car. He went back to get something and then tried to get back out. There were reports that Boeheim was directing traffic afterward. I heard you were trying to keep people away and warn them, I say. I got a letter from a guy who said I saved his life because he was going too fast and he saw me and slowed down and was able to get off. But it's a terrible thing. You know that you did everything you could and it just didn't work, and then somebody's dead and it's just terrible. There's no way to talk about it or explain about it. Jim Boeheim stares straight at me. He's rock solid, not choked up or overly emotional. Not that I can see. He leans back in his chair and widens his eyes. Well, the only thing that shouldn't be said, maybe, he begins. He reaches out and puts a finger squarely on his heart. I grew up in a funeral home. I'm different than most people. I grew up with people dying and picking up people who had died and bodies. I mean, it's different for me. He falls into a palms-up demeanor. It just is. I was close to my grandmother. I loved her and everything. When she died, I went to the funeral, and that was it. I felt that I could take it. It's just life. That's what happens, he says. I felt like I could take it. He thinks back then, not looking for what makes him especially resilient. He wheels out one of his soda fountain stories. In my sophomore year, high school, I had a really big game, just great, and I went down to the local soda fountain, and the guy waited on four people and didn't say anything. He ignored me. So I just sat there until he came by and said, well, what do you want? Bam raises his eyebrows then, to be sure I'm still with him. He's got his hands folded on his belly, his feet up on his desk. And he was just joking around, you know. Small town, you're like everybody else. There's no difference. I was brought up like that. That's what I believe. I don't think I'm better or different than anybody else. He raises one eyebrow, holds his palms out, tilts his hand a little. It's a look he sometimes gives when he thinks people don't get him. But I get him. You couldn't not. And there's a photo here of Jim Boeheim sitting at a table wearing an orange Nike kind of golf shirt with a Syracuse S on it. And the caption reads, Legacy. In his 44th season, Boeheim will coach his own son. He and his wife run a charity that gives away millions. His program is a powerhouse. Of the fatal accident, he says, it's a terrible thing. You know that you did everything you could. I'm going to go back to the front of the magazine to the section called The Big Bite and read a few shorter pieces from there. This is under the TV slug, the headline, Twitter wants to see this guy naked. William Jackson Harper of The Good Place reflects on abs and the afterlife by Matt Miller. One night in 2017, William Jackson Harper found himself at a dance party with his Good Place co-stars. There he was with Kristen Bell, Jamila Jamil, and Ted Danson, who dances with, quote, a lot of hands, a lot of faces, as Harper describes. It was one of those moments where I had to take stock of my life and just really appreciate that I'm on a set with this cast, he says, and I was getting paid to do it. A few years earlier, before he was cast on the beloved NBC comedy, Harper, then a theater actor, had considered leaving the industry. He was getting work, but, quote, I was still broke all the time, and I was tired of it, he says. It felt like I was going to always have several roommates. I was always going to be on stage in the last week of a play, wondering if I had enough money to get to the next month. Then came The Good Place, which follows a group of strangers trying to navigate the existential, ethical, religious, and philosophical quandaries of the afterlife. The show has racked up a number of Emmy and Golden Globe nominations and has won a Peabody. Despite its success and dedicated fan base, creator Mike Schur made the bold choice to wrap up the series on his terms with season 4. Though he doesn't want to say goodbye to the show, Harper sees the decision to end The Good Place as, quote, the right vision, unquote. He says these concise 4 seasons will exist as this little psychedelic bullet train of art, as opposed to slowly but surely just becoming a show that no one likes because we ran out of ideas. Big ideas have never been lacking on The Good Place, which has Harper's character, Chidi, often lecturing about the nuances of Aristotle. That doesn't mean the show is all homework, however. The Good Place turned Harper into something of a heartthrob after an episode with a lot of shirtless Chidi went viral. The actor, who was terrified about doing a shirtless scene, dieted and worked out relentlessly before shooting, and even avoided social media when the episode aired. He didn't know what anyone thought until, as he says, my buddy texted me and he said, yo, Twitter wants Chidi to get naked. He assures me that the final season won't feature naked Chidi. Trying to maintain that kind of shape for me, it's tough. I'm 39, man. That was not fun to do. Even though the series won't be appeasing the internet's thirstiness, he does hope the finale is satisfying for fans. There's no way to find answers to the eternal existential questions, but the show has stayed grounded in concepts that people continually grapple with. We can start from that foundation. Then from there, we just make it up, Harper says. Who knows if this bears any resemblance to what exists beyond us, you know? One thing he does tell me is that the ending is, quote, beautiful, and we go to a place that we haven't gone in the show thus far. Which is interesting phrasing, considering that in its first 3 seasons, the show has not actually been to the titular good place. So I ask whether he means this place in the final season of the physical or emotional sort. I'm not going to answer that one, Harper says. I'm going to leave that one out there. As for what exists beyond The Good Place, in the summer he starred in the critically acclaimed daylight horror film Midsommar. And this fall, he'll be opposite Anne Hathaway in Todd Haynes' legal drama about an environmental suit against DuPont. He'll also appear on Amazon's Jack Ryan. Details about his role are scarce, but he does say his character keeps his shirt on. Now under the slug food. Chew on this. More than a decade after Noma's opening, Copenhagen is the capital of mind-blowing culinary experiences. But have restaurants that aim to provoke gone too far? By Jeff Gordonier. And the photograph looks like part of someone's head and their eyebrows and the top of the bridge of their nose and the very tips of their ears kind of all sliced off and sitting flat on a table. The caption reads, this is your brain on foie foam. At Copenhagen's Alchemists, dishes like food for thought, foie gras topped with aerated foie gras foam, are meant to make you, think. It's made from the livers of geese that haven't been force-fed. I have visited thousands of restaurants in my lifetime, but over the summer, I got an early peek at the strangest one I've ever seen. This happened in Copenhagen. The Danish city has been a vortex of culinary innovation for about 15 years now, thanks to the ripple effect of Chef René Redzepi's Noma. But nothing could have prepared me for Alchemist. I met 28-year-old chef Rasmus Munk outside what appeared to be a warehouse. We stepped inside and beheld a Roy Lichtenstein-style tableau of New York City street scenes from graffiti artist Lady Iko. Then we moved out into a wine cellar that looked like something out of The Matrix. 8,000 bottles stacked three stories high in glass towers with transparent glass floors. Then we ambled into what resembled the interior of an observatory. Diners at Alchemist sit in darkness at places illuminated by tiny lamps and gaze upon a domed vista of a sky filled with stars. Munk told me that when the dome was completed, he instructed the designer to go back to the drawing board because he felt that his panorama of the aurora borealis and floating jellyfish was slightly askew. That must have been an expensive redo, but hey, erecting Alchemist is said to have cost around $15 million anyway, and a meal with wine will set you back $600, more if you want a bottle of Petrus. There are performers to pay, not just servers, but also trained thespians who interact with you, a la mariachis and mimes, and dishes that force you to confront the issues of the day, from climate change to racism to avarice to pollution to African water shortages to oceanic debris. There is a course that's meant to mimic a clot of plastic polluting the sea. There is also a lamb brain, crimson from cherry juice, sliced by your side. That's meant to shock you with the reality of how much food goes to waste. Munk calls that one, think outside the box. Toto, we're not in Noma anymore. No need to slap a category on all of this. Munk has already done so. He calls it holistic cuisine. In the same way as the ancient alchemists sought to fuse philosophy, natural science, religion, and the arts to create a new understanding of the world order, the aim of holistic cuisine is to redefine and broaden our understanding of the concept of dining, the alchemist site tells you. The ancient alchemists were con men, but whatever. Look, I like to think of myself as an ally of risk-takers and envelope pushers, and it would be all too easy to mock an enterprise that appears to edge perilously close to the restaurant in Always Be My Maybe, the one at which Keanu Reeves, in headphones, sheds tears for the animal that has died so that he can be fed. But I'd be lying if I told you that I want to eat at Alchemist. I care deeply about climate change, yet I don't necessarily go to a restaurant to worry about it even more. I go to a restaurant to get away from the awful news for a few hours. That's an antiquated perspective, though. We are experiencing a surge of restaurants that give paying customers the opportunity to experiment with their own discomfort, especially, ironically, at the high end. In Houston, at Indigo, Chef Johnny Rhodes invites you to contemplate, via tasting menu, the odious history of slavery, racial oppression, and mass incarceration. In Los Angeles, at Vespertine, Chef Jordan Kahn ushers you into a veritable spaceship where everything from gelatinous bites to repeated loops of music is meant to foster as much disorientation as pleasure. Does this represent the future of fine dining, or is it a decline of the Roman Empire sign of its imminent demise? I will only say that I spied a different vision of restaurant bliss right down the street from Alchemist in the once-abandoned Refshaleon area of Copenhagen. This was a place called La Banchina. It's a shack overlooking the harbor where you can order some anchovies and a glass of wine. There's swimming in the summer, a sauna in the winter. You don't think much about the sorry state of the planet at La Banchina, but you will come away feeling better. And that, my friends, is its own form of alchemy. And there's a sidebar that says, three next wave Copenhagen spots we love. Iluka, hyper-fresh seafood from Australian-born Noma veteran Bo Klugston. Apollo Bar and Canteen, having a quiet, civilized breakfast of soft-boiled eggs, ham and cheese in a high-ceilinged museum space tucked away from the phone-toting throngs at Nyhaven. Slurp, ramen and gyoza with a new Nordic undercurrent, courtesy of another Noma soldier, Chef Philip Inreiter. And then there's also a photo of that lamb brain dish. And indeed, it's a lamb brain that appears to be kind of covered in a cherry gelatin. The caption reads, have a think. This is lamb brain. The red coloration comes from cherry juice. It's sliced tableside at Alchemist. And we've got a story under the slug drinks. In defense of the pickleback, The Divey Special is now fancy enough for cocktail bars. And Home by Sarah Rince. The first pickle juice I ever drank straight was at a horrendous dive bar in the East Village called Continental, a place where crusty bartenders doled out 5 shots of anything for $12, the sting of which you could mask with $2 picklebacks. A bargain! Continental filed for bankruptcy twice, then closed last year. The pickleback, usually a shot of Irish whiskey, followed by a shot of sour brine, lived on. And not only is it still a shot-taking station staple in New York, where it was christened more than a decade ago, but it has also improved its lot and become something you actually want to drink rather than something you begrudgingly accept as your punishment for having to go out and have fun. On cocktail menus these days, you can find fancy picklebacks that stray from the whiskey pickle juice template. Kaido, in Miami, sells a version that's a shot of Suntory Whiskey Tokai, followed by a shiitake mushroom brine chaser. The Belfry, in New York, has an entire pickleback menu, with shots including the BBQ Back, Bullet Bourbon and Smoky Brine, and the Tickleback, Mezcal and Chipotle Sour Brine. Brewdog bars in the UK regularly experiment with whiskey brine combos. The thing about the pickleback that sets it apart from, say, a Jello shot, is that the brine is actually tasty, which makes throwing a few back at home perfectly acceptable, especially if you use homemade brine. Any recipe for pickling cucumbers will supply you with juice, and, bonus, you'll get actual pickles out of it. In her book Pickle Juice, Florence Cherouot, founder of the London-based bottled brine company The Pickle House, outlines brine recipes with more bite, like a tomato-based Holy Maria and a hot smoked chili back. But her go-to combo remains straight-up pickle juice. "I absolutely love doing it with Nika whiskey from the barrel," she says. For those with serious qualms about tossing back shots and chasers in the kitchen, a pickle juice cocktail might be less savage. One of Cherouot's favorites is a shot of vodka and a shot of pickle juice, topped off with ginger ale over ice, and finished with a squeeze of lime. A bartender at Pine Box Rock Shop in my Brooklyn neighborhood builds a mean spicy pickle margarita off-menu if you beat the crowds to her section of the bar. But the simple pairing of booze and salt, for me, that's Jameson and Bubby's kosher dill pickle brine, always does it right, one shot and chaser at a time. And there's a small sidebar here. Brine, straight up. Forgo the jar of pickles for a big bottle of nothing but the good stuff. Prefer your pickle brine without garlic knobs, dill stems, and coriander seeds? Lucky you. Entrepreneurial folks are bottling the stuff and selling it straight, like the Brine Brothers Darn Good Dill and Chili Cherry Fire varieties. Pour one into a shot glass to chase whiskey. Drink it plain, soaking in those electrolytes. Even try freezing it in an ice tray and eating a cube or 4 on Sunday morning. After all, pickle juice is as close to a foolproof hangover cure as we've ever known. Just don't use those cubes to make a whiskey on the rocks. It'll taste like rot gut. That's about it for this episode of Esquire. We'll come back next week with perhaps a few more from the October issue and then move on to November. This is Jay Stowe signing off. Have a great week.